Well, tonight we're going to finish our series through Genesis 11. So we're going to go through, start in Genesis 10, which is mostly a list of names. And I'll point out some of the names that are more significant from a biblical perspective. And I'm going to share the screen so you should be able to see some maps that I've got here. Let's see. There we go. So in Genesis 10, he begins to list the descendants of Shem, Ham, and Japheth after the flood. And he begins with the sons of Japheth. And he says, verse 2, the sons of Japheth were Gomer. And Gomer is really only mentioned one other time in the Bible, and that's Ezekiel. And then Magog. And Magog is actually mentioned three times, twice in Ezekiel and once in Revelation. And then Madai is never even mentioned again, except in the genealogies in 1 Chronicles. And then Javan. So if you look at this map, the reddish region would be where the Japhethites settled. The yellow region is where the Shemites settled, and the green region is where the Hamites settled. And the thing to remember, this list of names and this dispersion on this map took place after the Tower of Babel. So if you want to put this in a chronological order, you would put Genesis 9 and then Genesis 11 verses 1 to 9 and then Genesis 10. But Moses, when he writes this, is going to go through this list of names because some of these names are important to what's going to happen later on in Genesis 11. So he just gets it done first. So Gomer and Magog would be up in this region in the north here, northern, what we would call Turkey. The Javanites would be the coastal regions here. And then you've got Tubal, and I don't think this map actually shows everything. There's Tubal kind of in the middle. And Meshech and Tiras. Tiras is never mentioned again. And then he goes into the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz and Riphath and Togarma. And then the sons of Javan, Elisha and Tarshish. We're going to see Tarshish a lot because that's the place that Jonah wanted to flee to. Kittim, you're going to see that a lot. That would be part of Cyprus. And Dodanim. Now, the thing to remember here is when you see words ending in I am is a Hebrew plural. So Kittim and Dodanim are not the names of individuals, they're names of people groups. And the same thing later on when we get into the Ites, the Canaanites and the Hivites and all the other Ites. So from these, the coastlands of the nations were separated, and that's going to take place in Genesis 11. Everyone according to his language, according to their families, into their nations. And keep in mind that in the beginning, when they came off the ark, and I'll get into more of the detail of this once we get into chapter 11. They stayed as a single group. They didn't spread out. And so when they moved from the Ararat region, they traveled down. They traveled as one giant family. And it was only after God came down to confuse their languages that they split up. So there was a huge settlement that actually traveled together. And then he goes into, beginning in verse 6, the sons of Ham. And the sons of Ham are important because this is where the Canaanites come from. And all of the other ites that the Jews are going to have to contend with when they get into the promised land. So the first son of Canaan, or the first son of Ham, is Cush. And Cush would be this region down here. It would be the region south of what we know as Egypt. It would have been Sudan. It would have been Ethiopia. A lot of times in the Old Testament, they translate Cush as Ethiopia. But Ethiopia is too small. The region of Cush was much larger than what is now modern East Ethiopia. The next son would be Mizraim, and Mizraim is just another name for Egypt. So the Egyptians were Hamites, and then Put, and then Canaan. And so the Canaanites, you know, we know all about them. Those are the guys that we find throughout the Old Testament. And then he talks about the sons of Cush being Seba and Havilah and Sabta and Reama. And I've got a list here. And you should have gotten this this list in the prayer chain email. It gives all of the descendants, the sons, the grandsons, the great-grandsons, the great-great-grandsons, and so on and so forth. After the sons of Cush, he talks about the sons of Reama, Sheba, and Dedan. And also keep in mind, some of these names are repeated elsewhere in this genealogy. So keep in mind that there may be two individuals from completely different families with the same name. And that's something you have to keep in mind. And elsewhere in the Old Testament as well. So from Cush became the father of Nimrod. And he describes Nimrod as a mighty one on the earth. Now that word, that term mighty one, it's the same term that was used back in Genesis 6, verse 4, to describe the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men. And it's a term that's very often used of a warrior, a champion, a military person, and in fact, some translations actually call Nimrod a mighty warrior or a valiant warrior. So Nimrod was a military man. He was a conqueror. And verse 9 tells us he was also a mighty hunter before the Lord. So in addition to his military might, his conquering ability, he was also noted for his hunting prowess. And so much so that they even came up with a proverb, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. And some people make a little too much out of this term hunter. I've heard interpretations, well, he was a hunter of souls. I think that's taking it way too far, because the term simply means someone who hunts game for food. And it's most often used in Genesis of Esau. So remember, Esau was the skillful hunter, and his father Isaac loved the game that he caught. That's just what this word means. Nimrod was a mighty hunter, and the phrase before the Lord is probably a superlative. In other words, Nimrod was such an amazing hunter that there was not another person on earth before the Lord that was as good as him. He was remarkable. I wouldn't take it anything any farther than that. And he talks about the beginning of his kingdom. And I'll take you back to the map. He says the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. So when they travel down, Babel would be Babylon here in this map. And then Erech and Akkad and Calneh would have been in this region down here in what was called the land of Shinar. So Shinar was this region. Later on, it would become known as Mesopotamia. Later on, it would become known as the country of Babylon. That was the beginning of his kingdom. And then from Shinar, he traveled up the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, and he built Nineveh, which would eventually become the Assyrian capital, and Rehoboth-ir, and Calah and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. And that's the great city. And the great city there would be a reference to Nineveh, because Jonah, for example, four times refers to Nineveh as the great city. Now, I think what's important here, if you look at this map, these are, the yellow is Shemite, but Nimrod is Hamite. So what happened is these Shinar and Babylon and Nineveh were originally Hamite settlements. And later on, the Shemites conquered them so that they became Semitic settlements. And in fact, one of Shem's sons or one of his descendants, his son Asher. Asher is where we get the name Assyria from. So even though Nimrod the Hamite founded Nineveh, Asher the Shemite conquered it, and it became a Shemite or Semitic region. So that's just a little note. Mizraim became the father of Ludim. And again, these are Hebrew plurals, so they're references to people groups rather than just individuals. So Ludim would be the group descended from Lud. Anamim and the Lehabim and the Naphtahim and the Pathrushim and the Kaslahim, from which came the Philistines and the Kaphtarim. So the Philistines are Hamites descended from the individual who founded Egypt. And there's lots of debates about where he says the Kasluhim from which came the Philistines, because there's this overlap of the Kasluhim and the Kaphtarim. So it's kind of hard to determine which came first and who came from what and whatnot. I've got some stuff in my notes if you want to look at it sometime. I don't want to get into it now. And then Canaan, he became the father of Sidon. And Sidon, Tyre and Sidon were Phoenician cities that are mentioned quite often in the Old Testament. And Heth would be the father of the Hittites. And we know the Hittites because Abraham purchased the field and the cave from the Ephron the Hittite. You have Bathsheba's first husband, Uriah the Hittite. Esau's wives were Hittites. Then you have the Jebusites. The Jebusites were the original founders of Jerusalem. In fact, the original name of Jerusalem was Jebus. And then later on, it was conquered. Ornan, the guy that David bought the threshing floor from to stop the angel of the Lord, was a Jebusite. then you've got the Amorites. The most famous Amorites were Sihon and Og. Then you've got the Girgashites. And we know absolutely nothing about the Girgashites. Then you've got the Hivites, the Gibeonites, who deceived Joshua, were Hivites. Shechem, the person who raped Dinah, was a Hivite. Then you've got the Arkites. Nothing is mentioned elsewhere in the Bible about the Arkites or about the Sinites. The Arvadites are only mentioned one other place in Ezekiel. The Zemarites are never mentioned again. The Hamathites are mentioned. That would have been on the very northernmost border of Canaan. And he says, afterward, the families of the Canaanites were spread abroad. This would have been after the incident in Babel. And then he explains the territory of the Canaanite from Sidon in the north down to Gerar and Gaza in the south, and then Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah and Zeboim in the east. So it was the territory that would become the promised land. And then he says, these are the sons of Ham according to their languages, their lands, their nations. And then he gets into the sons of Shem. And he says, Shem is the father of all the children of Eber. And the genealogy would be Shem, Arpachshad, Shelah, and then Eber. So what Moses is attempting to do is to show that Eber, who gives his name to the word Hebrew, was a Shemite. Now, the next statement in verse 21, it all depends on your translation. New American Standard and a number of the more modern translations say that Shem is the older brother of Japheth. The King James, the New King James, and surprisingly the NIV say that Shem was the brother of Japheth the elder. So some translations have Shem as the older brother, other translations have Japheth as the older brother. If you look at the Hebrew, how it's worded, it would lead me to believe that Japheth is the older brother. Same thing with the Septuagint. Why these, I've got six translations that say Shem is older, three translations plus the Hebrew and the Greek that say Japheth is older. So flip a coin and pick one. Then he goes and he talks about Shem. And Shem, the sons of Shem were Elam. These would be the Elamites. Ashur. Ashur would be Assyria. So Ashur would have gone north, conquered the territory that originally belonged to the Hamites, and made the territory Shemite. And then Arpachshad and Lud and Aram. And Aram would be the Arameans. And the Arameans are going to come into play quite a bit, because Rebekah, Isaac's wife, was Aramean. Jacob's wives were Aramean. Jacob is actually described as the wandering Aramean. So the Arameans were sons of Shem. And then he talks about the sons of Aram were Uz. And Hull and Gether and Mash, and they're never mentioned again. And then Arpachshad became the father of Shelah. Shelah became the father of Eber. And Eber is where we get our term Hebrew. And then two sons were born to Eber. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth was divided. So when Peleg was around, that's when the Tower of Babel took place. And then he goes into some of the descendants of Joktan. Most of them you will never see again. So I'm not even going to bother to read them. There are a couple, though. Ophir, this is the place that's noted for gold, the gold of Ophir. And Havilah, you're gonna see several more times in the Old Testament. Their settlement extended from Mesha as you go to Sephar, the hill country of the east. And I think he mentions this hill country is because everyone is moving east. So in chapter 11, they're going to move from Ararat, they're going to head east. From there, they're going to spread out. Then Lot, he moves east. So everybody tends to move east. Even in Genesis 4, Cain moved east. So they mention that. These are the sons of Shem according to their families, their languages, their lands, their nations. The sons of Noah according to their genealogies and so forth, so on and so forth. Now, when we get into chapter 11, again, keep in mind that these people were one gigantic family. And so the whole earth, or more specifically, the whole inhabited earth, because they were pretty much all together, same language, same words, which made sense. We're all in the same family. We're all in the same community. We haven't spread out yet. It would make sense that we speak the same language and the same words. And it came about as they journeyed east. And if you look at this this map, they're probably somewhere in this region up here, and they're journeying east, and actually east and south. And they come and they find the plain in the land of Shinar. So what they're most likely doing is they're traveling along the Tigris-Euphrates River, and they find a really nice plain, nice flat spot. It's being irrigated by the Tigris-Euphrates River. Great place to settle. So they decided this is where we're gonna live. And so they said, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they used brick for stone and tar for mortar. So they're gonna create a civilization in the plain of Shinar. And from their building materials, I think they hoped it would last, but it wasn't gonna last. Instead of using stone, they used handmade bricks. Instead of using some sort of concrete type mixture, they used tar. So from the very beginning, their civilization was kind of doomed. Then they said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city." So they got the building materials. They're going to build a nice city, a nice settlement. And we're going to build a tower whose top will reach into heaven. And there's a couple of different views regarding that. The one that I would subscribe to is this tower was kind of a symbol of their defiant autonomy. They were already in the process of setting God aside. Because back in Genesis 9, God had told them, "I want you to fill the earth. I want you to populate the earth." And they're not doing it. They're stuck together in one giant community, and they're not filling anything. They're not populating the earth. They're just staying together, and this tower is going to be the focal point of our civilization. So there, you've already got this defiant streak coming back in mankind, and we're not going to go out like God said and wander and scatter. We're going to stay together. And they had two purposes in mind. Let's make for ourselves a name. And that term, let's make for ourselves a name, actually has its roots in what took place before the flood. So in before the flood, where in Genesis 6:4, he talks about the offspring of the sons of God and the daughters of men were the mighty men of old, men of renown. That word renown is the word name. So these offspring of the sons of God and daughters of men were men of name. And now you've got these post-flood guys doing exactly the same thing. Let's make a name for ourselves, something that's going to be remembered. We're going to go down in history because we're going to make ourselves famous. Otherwise, and this is the second reason I think they did this, we're going to be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. They knew what God had told them to do. They just don't want to do it. So let's build this city. Let's build this tower so it can be seen from the entire plain. Let's have a centralized location, a focal point for our civilization. Otherwise, we're going to be scattered. And they didn't realize that what they feared the most was going to come upon them pretty quick. So God came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. I think Moses, when he's writing this, is kind of being humorous. So mankind's greatest achievement at this point was this colossal tower. And yet, it was puny. From God's perspective, God actually had to come down to see it. This tower whose top is going to reach into heaven was so puny that God had to come down out of heaven just to see it. I think that's, you know, Moses is kind of poking fun at these guys. Your tower is not that big as you think. The Lord said, behold, they're one people, and the one people there, it's the idea of kinship. They're one kin. This is one family. And they all have the same language. So you've got this oneness of kin, this oneness of language, and that became a concern for God. God is taking this seriously. Even though their tower was puny from his perspective, God is taking this quite seriously, and he says, if this is what they began to do, nothing is going to be impossible for them. He says, nothing which they purpose will be impossible for them to do. And that word purpose there usually has negative connotations. In other words, in other places in the Old Testament, it's translated scheme or plot. And that's the idea that's coming across here. God is saying that these people are one kin, one language, and if this is what they began to do, then nothing that they scheme or plot in defiance against God is going to be impossible. If this is the beginning, it's only going to get worse. And the results would be catastrophic for the human race. So God is going to nip this one right in the bud. We're going to put a stop to this right here, right now. So God says, he actually, when Moses writes this, he uses the same words. The people said in verse 3, come, let us make bricks. Verse 4, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower. And now God says, come, let us go down and confuse them. So God comes down, and notice the us again. This is the fourth time where this us is used in Genesis. No, third time, sorry. Come, let us go down and confuse their languages, and they'll so that they won't understand one another. So they began this defiance, and God is going to put a stop to it. And the way he's going to put a stop to it is confuse their languages so that they can't understand one another. They're going to stop building. They're going to move on. So no more are they going to be able to understand each other's speech. God confused their languages. We don't know how many languages he created. At the present time, there's a website called Ethnologue, and at the present time, there are 142 language families on Earth today, and within those families, there's a total of over 7,100 languages on Earth today. Now, probably he didn't create all of them back then, because we know that languages tend to evolve and split and whatnot as history goes on. Dialects are formed and whatnot. So God comes down, gives them all different languages. You know, let's say he gave them 100 different languages. And now nobody understands what the other guy's saying. Hand me a hammer, and the guy scratches his head, speaks in some Chinese language or whatever. I don't understand what you're saying. And so they just threw up their hands and no point in continuing to build this thing. So the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. They stopped building the city. So now they're finally obeying God's original directive in Genesis 9. I want you to fill the earth. I want you to populate it. If you're not going to do it willingly, I'm going to force you to do it. So he made their lives kind of miserable and forced them to do it. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole earth. Actually, there's two different words there. The word Babel really doesn't mean confused. It just sounds like the word, the Hebrew word for confused. So that's why most people use that, say Babel means confused, when it actually really doesn't. So he says it's called Babel because, one, God confused their language, and two, from there, the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the whole earth. So now they've been scattered. And now God's plan continues. So beginning in verse 10 all the way down to 26, we kind of continue the genealogies that we saw back in chapter 5. So Genesis 5, Genesis 11 are the two genealogies in Genesis. So Shem is 100 years old, became the father of Arpachshad 2 years after the flood. And then Shem lived 500 years after he became the father of Arpachshad. He had other sons and daughters. Notice what's missing. Remember the phrase back in chapter 5 that was repeated with every single person except Enoch. And he died. You don't see that here. They still died, obviously, but Moses isn't repeating that. Then Arpachshad became the father of Shelah. Shelah became the father of Eber. And one other thing you should notice, they're getting younger. that the hundreds of years, the multi-century lifespans you saw back in Genesis 5 are no longer the case. They're much, granted, they're still really long. I mean, Abraham lived to be 175 years. Terah lived to be 205. But you don't see 600, 700, 800 year lifespans anymore. And they're also getting younger when they're having kids. You know, some of these guys back in Genesis 5, they were over 100 years old or older when they started having kids. Now they're getting younger. You know, here's Shelah's 30 years old, Eber's 34 years old, Peleg's 30 years old, Reu is 32 years old, Serug is 30 years old, Nahor's 29 years old. They're getting younger when they're having kids. Now, Abraham, the exception to the rule, but that was a miraculous thing. So we go through this genealogy, and he kind of goes through kind of quick. Eber became the father of Peleg, and then Peleg became the father of Reu, and Reu became the father of Serug, and Serug became the father of Nahor, and Nahor became the father of Terah. And this is where we really need to go, because Terah is Abraham's father. So verse 27, and I'm going to give you Abraham's family tree here. And this is by no means complete. There are lots of names missing, but these are the names that are important for us. Like Haran actually had another daughter, but she's not important in what we need to discuss. So these are the generations of Terah, verse 27. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran became the father of Lot and also Milcah. Now, one of the things I think you should notice about Terah, Abram, Nahor, and Haran, they were all, including Abram, they were all polytheists. In Genesis, or in Joshua 24, verse 2, Joshua said, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, from ancient times your fathers lived beyond the river, namely Terah, the father of Abraham and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods." So Abram, along with his father and brothers, were polytheists. And at some point, the one true God spoke to Abram. And I'm sure he was quite surprised, because he's never heard a God speak before. And it wasn't coming from some idol. This was an audible voice coming from heaven. And Abram listened. And at some point, according to Genesis 31:53, Nahor and Terah also became believers in the one true God. Because when God is mentioned, he's mentioned as the God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, the God of their father. So they started out as polytheists, and eventually they all became believers in the one true God. We know when Abraham did, we just don't know when the others did. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his birth, in the land of the Chaldees. And so if you look at a map, is pretty close to the Persian Gulf. It's on the Euphrates River. And so God calls Abram, I'm jumping ahead. Verse 29, Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. If you look at the diagram here. And the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah. So Abram's wife, Sarai, is actually his half-sister. Abram and Sarai had the same father, Terah, different mothers. And Genesis 20, verse 12 points that out. Nahor marries his niece. So Nahor married his brother Haran's daughter. So Nahor's wife, Milcah, is actually Lot's sister. And these two, Nahor and Milcah, are going to come into play because they give birth to Bethuel. Bethuel gives birth to Rebekah, who marries Isaac. And then Laban, Rebekah's brother, has Rachel and Leah, who become Jacob's wives. So in the diagram I gave you, the red lines indicate marriages. Sarai is barren. Obviously, it's not going to always be the case. Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. They went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans, in order to enter the land of Canaan. Now, the actual sequence of events is derived from looking at several places in Scripture. You need to look here in Genesis 11. You need to look at what Stephen says in Acts 7. You also need to look at what Nehemiah says in Nehemiah 9. And I'll just give you the composite, the sequence of events. So according to Acts 7, God appeared to Abram while he was still in Ur and told him to leave his country and his relatives and go to the land that he'd be shown. And according to Genesis 15 and Nehemiah 9, God actually was the one who led Abram out of Ur. Now, Terah, being the patriarch of the family, it would appear that he was not going to be left behind, according to verse 31 here. He wasn't going to be left behind by his son Abram, especially since his other son Haran was dead, and Nahor's off someplace else starting a family. Terah's not going to be left behind. So he and Lot and Abram and Sarai, they leave Ur together, and they head up the Euphrates River, and they're going to enter Canaan. Now, Terah, being the patriarch, takes the lead. And that's what Moses gets at here in verse 31. Terah took Abram, his son. But the other passages in Scripture indicate God was the one leading. Terah's the patriarch, so he goes to the head of the line. And they head up the Euphrates River, and for whatever reason, they decide to stop at Haran. And if you look at a map, Haran's actually a bit out of the way. They would have gone from about here and then just headed south, but instead they head up this little tributary to Haran. We're not told why. Maybe Nahor and his family were living there, and Terah decided, you know, I haven't seen Nahor in a while. Let's go up and pay him a visit. And that visit actually turned into something longer. They settled in Haran. Maybe Terah's health was failing. Eventually, Terah dies in Haran. And according to Genesis 12, after Terah's death, God speaks to Abram again and repeats, I want you to go forth from your country, your relatives, your father's house, to the land which I'm going to show you. So this is the second time he says that. He said it once in Ur, according to Stephen, and now he's telling him again in Haran, according to Genesis 12. And Abram, he sort of obeys. He leaves his country, but he doesn't leave his relatives. Lot goes with him. And that causes nothing but problems. Had Abram said to Lot, you know, you need to just stay here. Lot, remember, Lot is not a kid anymore. He's got some stuff. Abram's 75 years old when he comes into Canaan, according to Genesis 12. Lot's not a child. He should have said to Lot, you need to stay here. But instead, Lot comes with him. Then he had the whole land dispute between Abram's herdsmen and Lot's herdsmen. And Abram says to Lot, you know, let's not fight. Choose wherever you want to go, and I will go in the opposite direction. So Lot chooses the well-watered valley of the Jordan. And eventually he settles in Sodom, and then we know all of that. And eventually, two children are born. Moab and Ammon, who would become thorns in the sides of Israel throughout their entire history. Had Abram simply obeyed and said to Lot, stay here, none of that would have happened. So our actions have very long-lasting, wide repercussions. So the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. And then chapter 12, God calls Abram again, finally gets him into Canaan, and he's 75 years old. So any questions?
So how are we doing for questions out there? Jeff?
I have one, and okay. That's in relation to the Hittites. They seem to be in several areas. They're in an area, which is in Turkey,
a big yes. region
in Turkey called Cappadocia also.
Yep.
But also down in Syria, you know, in either Syria or Lebanon area today.
Yep. Yeah, the Hittites had they weren't limited to what we know as Canaan. In fact, they probably originally settled in that Turkey region and then from there spread out.
I see. Thank you.
Bo, do you have any academic additions to the comments about the Hittites?
You're muted.
So Boaz,
you're muted. I don't think she can hear us. There you go.
Okay, so among the academics, the Hittites were the first settled in Middle Bronze Age would be, I don't know, 2500 BC, what is now central Turkey, and their capital was like 80 miles off Hattusha. They lasted for 500 years, that the empire. And then by around 1000 BC, the empire fell because of the disturbances, around the Mediterranean region. So then those Hittites moved south to the areas of northern Syria and Canaan. So these would be, the historians or academics call it the New Hittite kingdoms, but yes, they you know, they would be mentioned in the Bible. I mean, it's still not really, you know, not really clear, but they, you know, what academics say is that they came from Black Sea region, you know, close to Armenia, you know, that region, around, I don't know, 2400-500 BCE, and they trickled into the Turkey area, and then they established the kingdom lasting from Old Kingdom from 1700 or 1800 BCE till 1100 BCE, and then, you know, all the civilizations collapsed at that time, and then, you know, they moved south.
Right. So
that's what the academia says, you know.
And that would make sense, because the time of Abraham when he encountered Ephron,
yeah,
would have been around 2000. Mm-hmm. David was around 1000, you know. Yeah. So you don't really see that empire during mm-hmm. the time of David, but you do see individual Hittites.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.